I'm Nick. I'm an artist based at Somerset House Studios in London. I'm interested in sound and how it plays with the imagination. And I'm building a machine. Bang.
Brown and furry.
An axe cutting through a watermelon.
Fire.
Peace.
The beginning.
Bubble wrap. Thundering rain.
Me.
I'm building a machine that can translate words into sounds, audible experiences. In this podcast, I discuss this idea with some amazing minds. I want to know what they think about the meaning of language, perception, and reality. I hope what I learn from talking to them will help me build this machine. When we began this project, I knew that the people we needed to talk to more than anyone were linguists, the scientists of language. I'm going to be talking to Angela Terrell, the first proper linguist that we've spoken to. I'm particularly interested to talk to Angela because of her groundbreaking fieldwork with languages that are completely unique. And I hope I'll be able to learn from her something about what makes a language unique, but also how certain aspects of language might be common to everyone.
My name's Angela Terrell, and my background is that I was trained as a linguist. That means that I am involved in the study of language, like the structure of language and the types of languages that exist, and how language is used and how it develops over time, and how children learn language. And my specialism is I work on what's called descriptive typology, which is I study the description of languages, so the grammatical structures that languages present. Each language has its own grammatical structure, and as linguists we want to know how they differ from each other, how they're similar to each other. I also look at the typology of languages, which is comparative. It compares one language to another, and it compares languages to each other across a broader scale, so across the languages of a region or else even the languages of the world. I'm interested in general terms in how languages differ from each other and how they're the same as each other. I zoomed in on a language called Lavukalevê, which is spoken in the Solomon Islands. It's spoken by about 1,500 people. It's a small language, but then in many parts of the world, languages are small. They do have small populations, and in the Pacific, if certainly in the Solomons, most languages are pretty. They have small speaker populations like that. And it's not in itself a sign that the language is dying. It's just a sign that it's always been a small language. It's an interesting language because it doesn't have any relatives. It's not part of a family of languages. It's just all there by itself in the Solomons. It's very different from the other languages of the Solomons. And if you ask anyone in the Solomon Islands, oh, yeah, Lavukalevê, yeah, that's a really strange language. I find that very satisfying.
Is that what you would call a language isolate?
Exactly. It's a language isolate. So in the Solomons, there's about 350,000 people. There's about 100 languages, depending how you count a language. And out of those, all but a handful are closely related to each other on the scale of maybe how German and English are related to each other. So they're quite similar. Then you get about four languages which are not related to each other. And this Lavukalevê is one of them. And that's why, to me, it was so interesting and so necessary to find out what it was like and why is it spoken where it's spoken and what is it about? Why is it that a language can be all by itself and surrounded by, you know, families of other languages. I think that's fascinating to think of.
How can it be isolated?
This is a really interesting question, and you have to think about whether it's related to the other related languages, as it were. So out of the four isolates in the Solomons, are they actually part of a family? And this is where linguists get a bit crazy and think, oh, yeah, must be. It's got to be related because they're not related to anything else. They must be related to each other. It's very easy to make a crazy theory and very hard to substantiate. And so I would urge caution and say, well, we don't have the evidence to show that those languages are related, so we don't know. A sort of hypothesis would be that there's a bunch of unrelated languages. They're called Papuan. In this area, Papuan just means not related to the other languages. And so in this area, you could say that all the Papuan languages are remnants maybe of an earlier people and maybe a very, very early migration into the region. If you think about the geography of the Solomons, it lies on a west to east axis, roughly. Think about Australia, think about the northeast of Australia, think about Papua New Guinea to the north, and all the islands lying off Papua New Guinea, going through New Britain and New Ireland, through Bougainville, through the Solomons. Those all have these isolate languages, and maybe they're all ultimately related to each other. That's one hypothesis, and so we wonder about that, but we don't have the evidence to say whether they are. And if they are, this would be a very early migration into the region, and they have evidence that there have been people in this region for up to 40,000 years, so it's a very early populated area. The jury's still out. We just don't know.
I presume an Englishman named New Britain.
Yeah, and then there's New Ireland as well.
So is the isolation linguistically anything to do with the isolation geographically? Is it coincidental that they are islands as well?
That's an interesting question. You can think of, I mean, at least in the Solomons, each of these languages basically has its own island. And languages kind of relate to one language, one island of these Papuan languages in the Solomons. Maybe. I can't say more than that. It's not really that isolated when you're there. It's full of people. The Solomons and the whole of the island, it's called Island New Guinea. The whole of Island New Guinea is full of people and full of life. And it's only isolated when you think of other areas of the world.
You spent a significant amount of time there.
I did, and I stayed in a small village called Mane, which has about 60 people living on it. The village was originally built only in the 1960s, actually. People moved to that island. It was started by three sisters and their families, so everyone's closely related. I wanted to work on this language because I was fascinated by it. I found the right people to talk to, chiefs and important people of the tribe, and there's a few tribes there, and they sent me to Mane Island. They said, that's the best place for you to work, so I went and lived there, and it was very isolated in that sense. There was no sort of regular transport or way of getting there. There was no water or electricity or postal service or anything that we might think of as the necessities of life. Turns out not necessary at all.
Is it right that the local radio would transmit messages for people once a week?
That's absolutely true, yes, yes. If I was in the going to the town and I needed to be picked up and taken to the village, I would send a message to a friend, and he would come with his canoe, and he would pick me up in the town and take me to the village, and then, hopefully pick me. I'd agree on a day where he'd pick me up again and take me home, which didn't always happen, unfortunately. But to go anywhere, you have to have the nexus of a canoe, a driver, and petrol. These are petrol canoes. So you need to have those three things all in the same place at the same time, and that can be very difficult. So it can be quite isolated in that respect. The longest I spent in one go was 6 months, but I spent up to about a year and a half or something there. So it was long enough to understand a little bit about, you know, what people talk about, what they're interested in, you know, what happens on a daily basis in the village. and just to sort of understand some of the structures of how people communicate. They had very basic questions for me, like things like, what colour is a white person's blood? They'd never seen a white person bleed, so they didn't know what colour their blood was. They always used the category white person. That's not my construct. Do white people die? Because it seemed from the few movies that people had seen that white people didn't seem to die in the same way that other people did. So, you know, there were some very basic questions that they had for me, which I thought was pretty fascinating.
It's interesting that they gathered that from a movie, which neatly brings me on to kind of narratives and storytelling, because the people I've been speaking to for this series have talked about how language originated as a means to recount events which had happened perhaps during the day, perhaps a hunt, and replay them for the community to learn from them. The sounds that were made were actually mimetic imitations of sonorous events. Is that your kind of reading of the origin of language?
We just don't know, and it's difficult to know how to answer it, because what kind of evidence could we have for a mimetic view of the origin of language? There's no language that's sort of only half constructed. All the languages we know are full languages that operate fully as a complete system. We don't have evidence of a language that's only just begun. I don't know. I think it's a very difficult question, actually.
Is a language which has remained unchanged for a long time the same as a language which has just begun? I mean, is it possible to observe a language isolate as if it's telling you things about language that are kind of nascent?
I wondered about this with Lovell Colliver, because maybe it's been unchanged for a long time, but I can see evidence of change in it. I can see that it's had contact with its neighbours, because they share words. So there has been change coming in from neighbours. And I can also see there's been internal change in itself, because I noticed that the grammatical words, the words like pronouns and verb particles and the ones that are doing all the work, they don't have the phoneme S in them. So the S occurs in lots and lots of words in Lovell Colliver, but it doesn't occur in the grammatical words. And that tells me that S is a new phoneme. It's new. It's a new sound to the language. And it's come in, I don't know where from, but it's come in. And it has got as far as normal words. And it hasn't penetrated as far as grammatical words. So that tells me that Lovell Colliver, isolate though it is changing, or has been changing.
So will a change, a sort of substrate, affect one level of the language first? So will nouns, for example, be subject to changing phonetics before grammatical components of a language?
Yes, that's probably true. You would expect that. So if a language, especially if a language was going to change because of contact with its neighbours, you'd expect words like verbs and nouns to be the first affected, especially nouns would be the first affected. Then later on verbs, and then only at the very later stages you'd expect grammatical changes. So I think that's a reasonable scenario, yeah.
There was something I gathered about your research which was to do with how the geography or the topography had influenced perception and linguistics in relation to spatial coordination.
The spatial coordination is really fascinating in this language, and it's the same actually in all the languages that I know about in the Solomons. All the islands lie on a northwest-southeast trajectory. So they take that axis and make it an up-down axis. So northwest is up and southeast is down. Then they also have the opposing axis. And then they also have an inland seaward trajectory, which they map onto the structure as well. So you go in and out and up and down. And how it works on the islands is really, really sensible and smart, but how to describe it makes it sound more complicated than it really is, I think. But it's definitely a case of geography shaping linguistic expression.
How is that mapped to language?
With words like going up and going down. They're verbs. So you go up, you go down, you go in, inland, and you go seawards, and you go northwest, and you go southeast. You don't just say, oh, go, you know, go to the house. You just say, go seawards to the house. And you don't just say, pass me the cup. You say, pass me the seawards cup, or pass me the inland cup. Every spatial action is mapped on to the geography of the islands.
Wow, that's absolutely incredible. That descriptive component is never absent.
It's pervasive. It's everywhere. It's absolutely pervasive. So most sentences will have one of these words in them.
Why do you think that's critical enough to find its way into language?
I think it's because the island geography is so pervasive in these places. It's not simple, but it's in your face. The island is the life, and this is what people know about the world. They know the structure of the island really, really well. So I think that's why it plays such a big role in language.
So presumably the fact that it's encoded in language now determines people's perception of the islands as they acquire the language.
Yeah, I think so. You can't learn one of these languages without learning a very complex and interesting spatial system. You can't talk without understanding the spatial system. So anyone learning these languages, this is one of the first things that they would come up against, one of the first things that they would learn.
Kind of leading on to this kind of question of whether language is deterministic of perception, or whether perception determines language, and the whole kind of Sapir-Whorf hypothesis thing. I'm trying to build sort of raises all these questions about where language exists, whether it's a sort of in here or out there. What do you think?
I think that language definitely shapes reality. So I strongly believe that Sapir-Whorf is right. And I think in a way we all think that, because for instance, we resist words like policeman and fireman now because those words are thought to limit our perception of those roles in the world, because a policeman doesn't have to be a man and a fireman doesn't have to be a man. And so using those words limits the perception of what those roles could contain. So we all believe in the Sapir-Whorf hypothesis on one level. But on the other hand, I think perception definitely shapes language. Humans build languages exactly as we want them. For instance, think about colour terms. The colour spectrum is completely undivided in reality, as far as I know. But languages divide up the colours into specific terms that they denotate with a particular word, and then they end up with, you know, six colour terms or however many colour terms. And those terms may or may not correlate with other colour terms in other languages. And I think there's no sort of perceptual reality there. I think both language shapes perception, and I think perception shapes language. I think both are true.
I'm very interested to know whether you think that there are cross-cultural commonalities, you know, having worked with language isolate, whether there are sound meaning representations which are human rather than cultural.
There are a few language universals. So all languages have consonants and vowels. We know that. All languages have a distinction between nouns and verbs. Whether there's sound meaning universals, it's difficult to say. There's some sounds that are really more common in some words than others. For instance, in pronouns, there's been work that shows that pronouns more often contain nasal consonants, so N's and M's and N's. occur much more frequently than chance in pronouns compared to in other words. So, yeah, you could say that there are sort of universal form meaning correspondences in language. Not universal, but widespread correlations.
Moving on to onomatopoeia and kind of mimetics and synesthesia, have you observed kind of correlations between pitch or volume in relation to volumetric space, the size of things in relation to the kind of volume of the voice or the pitch of the voice?
Words for small things generally have an I vowel in them across languages, and words for big things generally have like R vowels in them. English is a really bad example of this because big should be a word for small and small should be a word for big. But so forget English, but many other languages have I for small things and or R for big things. So there's definitely a correlation.
And could that be because of the shape of the cavity in the mouth that one needs to make those sounds?
Yeah, it could be. That would be the hypothesis, yeah, definitely.
So there's a sort of bodily relationship between meaning and physiology.
Yeah, I think that's fair to say, yeah.
I might have got this wrong, but I read that something you discovered in your fieldwork was the naming of body parts and how that differs.
Body parts is really interesting because if you compare them cross-linguistically, because you've got everybody has the same body, right? But how the parts get divided up into words is really different in different languages. And the language that I worked on is really interesting because they don't have a word for arm and leg. They just have a word for limb. So you could say your west limb is your leg and your east limb is your arm. So you can disambiguate. There's no chance that people are going to think that you've said leg when you actually said arm. Any time you need to disambiguate, you can. But in general, people don't. They just say limb. Oh, I've got a really sore limb. Once I saw a newspaper article about someone who'd been shot, and the girl who was talking about the article to me said, oh, he's been shot in the limb. Well, it was clearly the leg, you know, and she could have said he's been shot in the west limb, but she didn't. She said he's been shot in the limb. And I found that very, very interesting because most languages do have separate words for arm versus leg, and this language just doesn't. It just doesn't. And that's sort of a perceptual domain that really should be, you would think, would be reasonably commensurate between different languages. But again, languages divide up perceptual reality in different ways.
So do you think the body feels different if you don't distinguish between arms and legs?
No, I don't, because people always can disambiguate if they want to. So it's not like they don't know the difference between a leg and an arm. It's just that if it's not important, then they're not going to distinguish.
I've often thought the word articulation is really interesting because it refers both to language but also mechanics. The arm is kind of articulated differently, perhaps, to the leg, but actually the body could be perceived just as the colour spectrum is, as a continuous surface.
I think that's true. I think we don't need to divide them up in the same way. A lot of languages have a word that covers hand and arm, for instance, or leg and foot. And so they just say, oh, shake my arm for shake my hand, for instance. It's not hardwired what we're going to call these limbs, then, and they slide into each other. So it turns out they aren't sort of so readily segmentable as we might think. And this is exactly what our typological research is aimed at finding out. Are body parts, you know, universally segmentable? We don't know. Well, go and do the research. And so people do go and do the research, and we find out, no, actually, they're not similarly segmentable at all. They're quite different in different languages. And I think that's the attitude of going and finding out is what we really need to do.
It would be interesting to talk to a surgeon about anatomy and how that's kind of determined. I'm sure that we've got far more words for the body than we did 200 years ago.
Yeah, we've got specialist vocabulary that most people don't know. So most people don't know what doctors know about, you know, muscles and tendons and things like that. So yeah, any time you get specialist, then you start to get into a different level of granularity, and then yeah, then all bets are off.
Is the language that you worked with, does it have an orthographic system?
Well, it does now. It didn't really have one, or it had a few hymns that had been translated into Labu Kaleve, but people didn't like how they'd been written down because some of the symbols they thought were not very good. And it was written with the Roman alphabet, which, of course, you know, makes sense in that area. But I sat down with some people and we made a better alphabet, which I think they like better. So now they have a way of writing, but they're not a very sort of bookish people. They're not very sort of scholastically inclined, and they don't have good access to, you know, books and reading in any case. So there's sort of limited use for a writing system, but having said that, it's incredibly important that they have one just in case people do develop a desire and a need to write. So if they do that, then the writing system is in place.
So how do you set about working with someone to create an alphabet? I mean, is there a relationship between the voice sounds and the symbols?
Yeah, absolutely. So what I did was, on my first day of my first ever field trip, I sat down and recorded a word list of about 100 words, and then I transcribed them into the International Phonetic Alphabet. And then from there, I worked out what the different sounds, the contrasting sounds were in the language. And from there, I worked out how to represent them in a simple orthography, that you only want the sounds that differ from each other. So you don't want to be too detailed, and you don't want to be not detailed enough. From there, I presented some interested people with a few options of the tricky ones. Most of them were obvious what they should be. There was a few tricky ones, presented a few options, and we kind of agreed quite readily on how the tricky ones should be written. So that's basically what we did.
Can you give me an example of one of the tricky ones?
One of the tricky ones is it's called a velar nasal. It's an ng sound, like the sound at the end of the word sing. Ng. And it's tricky to write because in English we write it with an NG. In the previous prayers that I'd mentioned, they'd written it with an italic N, which is kind of really difficult to do, and unless you've got a nice computer, which they don't. And so there was a question about if you could write it with an N with a tail on it, which is how it would be written in the IPA. You could write it with an italic N, how it had been written, which nobody liked. Or you could write it with an NG, which people didn't first like because it's two symbols for one sound, so it's not really ideal. So we went sort of back and forth for a while and then decided that the easiest was the NG, and so that's what we went with. So people are still, I mean, there's no perfect solution to these problems, but people accepted the NG, so that's what we went with.
It makes me think of the Booba and Kiki synesthesia example of the two shapes, the round shape and the spiky shape. It's a kind of cognitive neuroscience experiment where you show two shapes. One's a kind of looks like a kind of splodge of paint, and the other one looks like a star. And you ask them which one is Booba and which one is Kiki. Everyone will always agree cross-culturally that Kiki is the spiky one.
Yeah, that's like the little and large example. So the I sounds are always going to be the small ones and the R sounds are going to be the big ones. Not always, but often.
Just to finish, I'm trying to build this machine. You speak into a microphone and the words that you've said will be used to form a picture in sound of the meaning of what you've said. And we're sort of using machine learning to try and extrapolate between a speech sound and an image, if you like. I've got two questions for you. One is that, you know, do you think language can be codified?
I think it can totally be codified. I think, yeah, you just look encoded. Yeah, I think it's, and I think, well, this is, in a way, it's an empirical question as well. You're going to try to do it. So if you do it, yes, then it can be done.
But do you think the gap in subjectivity is going to be impossible to bridge? Because I'm concerned that it's, what I'm trying to do is impossible, at least impossible to represent a word for an individual with a sound that's meaningful and is what they expect to hear individually, subjectively.
Yeah, it's just what we do every day that I think a machine can just do it. I'm quite excited by the idea, because I think that if you can do this with your machine, then that tells us something very interesting about human reality and human cognition, about what we're doing when we're speaking. And I'm waiting eagerly to see your machine.
Thursday, 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 Thurs